Hey, we are in gear, technically. So I'm Tom Talpe from Microsoft. I'm glad to be back at Samba XP. I don't know if this is my eighth or my ninth or something like that, but I enjoy coming here. So thanks for having me and listening to what we have to say and what I have to, pontificate on. So an outline of my talk today, it's not going to be incredible news, but I hope I will give more background and more insight, effectively. I'm going to talk about the SMB3 protocol changes that we've implemented over the past, give or take, year. Give a view, in borrowing some words from others, on the protocol futures, things you'll see in the coming months, just months. Wrap up with some possible Microsoft Samba collaborations. This is a theme I've talked about the past couple of years. I think it's led to some interesting discussion, and I hope that that is true today. Okay, first, SMB3 protocol changes. The document that we all know and love, MS-SMB2, has been updated for the new Windows and Windows Server, so-called 19H1 release. We're not using code names anymore at Microsoft. You may have noticed this term, 19H1, quite a lot. It's a year and a half, all right? 2019, first half. You can predict where the next one is going to land, 19H2. They're on a six-month rhythm. There's a different rhythm for Windows and Windows Server. Windows Server is has a long-term release. Windows Client, the Windows Workstation release, we used to call it, more of a rolling release every 6 months. So Windows Server goes through the same rolling release cycle, but in shorter updates, and every 3 years to 5 years, you'll see long-term servicing channels. So Server may or may not have a name at each one of these releases. Client will have a name. Anyway, the client's name is Windows 10 version 1903. It was released to manufacturing in March. That's why it gains 1903. It was actually shipped, as in the distribution channel, just a couple weeks ago, May 22nd. So that is coming to workstations near you. It is available on demand by the so-called seekers, people who actually look for this release and install it proactively. And it'll appear on workstations over the coming months as they become eligible for the upgrade and as the upgrade channel finds them. This thing is echoing a bit. Is that just the way it sounds from up here?
Yeah.
Okay. The document, MS-SMB2, is updated in advance of this release, approximately 45 days before the release. That's what we agreeing or committed to doing. So we published this document on March 13th. Embarrassingly, there were a couple of issues with the document, and I pushed out a special update. We don't normally do this, that hit the streets on April 30th. That big, hairy, GUID-based URL is the landing page for the MS-SMB2 document. If you go to there, you'll see the entire history, version history of that document going back to the mid-2000s. And you can actually view the old releases if you want. In particular, there's a PDF and a redlined update version to the previous release. And we do this every release. And so there's some very useful tools that will allow you to see the changes and see the first thing. I'm also going to cover in a couple of places our 18H2/Server 2019 release. It's been a year since we discussed anything, since I was here at Samba XP, and I figured I'd just wrap it up, roll it up into a full year coverage. You notice 18H2 and Server 2019 look a little different from the first one. Server 2019 was an official release of Server, a long-term servicing channel release of Server. The previous release was Server 2016, 3 years prior. So, you know, that's just an example of the slightly different cadence that client and server can be on. So the SMB3 protocol really just has two new features. They are surfaced in negotiate contexts, and they are compression and server net name. And really, the server net name is kind of a non-issue. You'll see how trivial it is. The compression is the major new feature. There is no dialect change. We remain on dialect 3.1.1. We've been there for years. We don't foresee a dialect bump. The only reason to make a dialect bump is if we change the way negotiation works. And we added negotiate contexts as well as tree connect contexts. So we don't anticipate a need to change the negotiation to bump the dialect. We might, who knows, but don't look for a 3.1.2 or an SMB4 in the near future. It does not appear to be necessary. There's no practical interoperability reason to perform a dialect bump. And so we don't think we're going to do it. As a result, though, most of these features are opt-in, right? You can simply ignore the features. And if you don't support them, you're a down-level version, you don't care to do it because it doesn't make any sense, whatever. You can just ignore a lot of these things. It's really, really convenient. It leads to a little bit of uncertainty in the feature set of the server you're interoperating with. So you do have to discover it. But it has been a real boon to interoperability. No more flag days. Okay, the first feature, compression, the big one, is a new negotiate context. It is called SMB2_compression_capabilities. It's defined in those two sections of MSSMB2. There's a request and a response structure for these for this operation. ID number is 3, and I put the 3 in red because that was the embarrassing omission in the March 13th release. This was previously 4. It started life as 3, and internally at Microsoft, while we were developing it, we said, oh, we got to change the format of this payload, and we changed it to 4, and then we had to change it again. Well, it turns out that it was more convenient to change it back to 3 at that point. And internally, it was changed to 3, and that number never filtered into the document. It's kind of an ugly story in a way, but it's just one of these little, I don't know, apocryphal stories. It was shipped by in error, so I'll get to what the difference was. But it's 3, trust me. And we probably won't use 4 at this point, right? Because we've already used 5. You'll see that in a second. So forget 4 ever existed. In addition to the negotiate context, once the feature is negotiated on a connection via the negotiate context, a couple of more protocol visible things come into play. The first is this new transform header, the SMB2 under compression under transform header. It is a second transform, we call them nested, that's specifically for compression. We could have changed the format of the transform header to put in this other stuff, but it was more convenient to optionally add this transform, and I think you'll see why. The transform header is described in 2.2.42, and there's also one more protocol visible thing called the read flag request compressed. That's where the client can send a read that he requests a compress response for. This may or may not be heavily used, but it is protocol visible and there is a processing rule associated with it. That's defined in 2.2.19, which is the read request structure. So the way it works is the client optionally, and that's an important word, negotiates compression by appending one of these new negotiate contexts. The context consists of a count and a counted array of algorithms. It can be have any number of algorithms in it, up to, there's probably a maximum defined, but it's effectively an open-ended array. It consists of the list of algorithms that the client supports, and it provides the opportunity to the server to pick one. It attempts to sort these algorithms by preference, but there are a couple of other considerations that come into play. In any event, usually the first one is the most preferred. That will typically be the one that's most efficient on the client for decompression. The server selects a subset based on what it supports. It could be none, and it responds with a subset of that array, basically, where n is the size of the server's response. And so in that response, you know the set of compression algorithms that are supported. Today, the algorithms supported are defined by another Microsoft document called XCA, the Express Compression Algorithm document. It has the Express algorithm, also known as LZ77, Express with Huffman encoding, and LZNT1. LZNT1 is basically a legacy. You can see the letters NT in it. That might give you a tip how old it is. And it's supported by the Microsoft compression library, but we don't expect it to be heavily used. Yes, Chris. Sure.
Is there a mechanism for external additions?
There's no defined mechanism, but the mechanism supports it. Yes. Currently, these are IDs 0, 1, and 2, and it's a 2-bit field or 2-byte field. So there is plenty of room for expansion in future. I'll get to what we anticipate. The interoperability story, there's a new compact transform header. This is the one I mentioned a minute ago, the compression header for SMB compression. This is the structure that changed that caused us to go from 3 to 4 and back to 3. There's a protocol ID, basically a compression protocol ID, an original segment size, an algorithm, a reserve field, and a compression offset field. The way this works is when it's inserted after a transform header. So if compression and signing are both needed, the transform headers will become nested, right? It could also be a standalone header with just the transform header. Compression always occurs first. I'll mention that in a minute. But basically, you may see several headers on the SMB message with this approach. Compression processing, defined in MS-SMB2, section 3.1.4.4, there's a choice of compression types by the sender. The sender decides how to compress on each operation. So in particular, the client can compress its requests, or the server can compress its replies. There's no requirement that the two are the same. You could send a compressed request and a compressed response, and they could be two different compression types. The compression type, and maybe none, the compression type is chosen by the sender as appropriate to the type of data, to the performance of compression, to the performance of the compression operation, how much CPU it takes, for instance, for each operation, right? And that may include not compressing at all. The client obviously may compress its writes. It may request that its reads be compressed, but the server may or may not have to comply with that, depending on whether it chooses to. There's also a compress all requests override. This is not actually protocol, more behavior, but our client supports a mode that just says, compress everything, please, right? If we can save any data whatsoever, please do so. It can still be overridden, but basically, normally it would be writes and reads. With the compress all requests option, all requests become eligible. We don't compress over RDMA. Once again, this is behavior. It kind of gets in the way of the RDMA story, right? If you've touched the data to process it and then you've offloaded its transfer, you know, why'd you bother? This is the same thing we get with encryption, the same question we face with encryption. Anytime a transform is applied to the data, it impacts the performance of RDMA. Not because RDMA has to handle it, but because you've done all this work prior to even starting the RDMA part of the process. Still, compression can benefit RDMA. It uses the wire. So in the future, I put for now, we may reconsider this. There may be lots of reasons to allow it. We can talk about how we're going to do that. Once the message, the compressed message arrives, decompression has to occur. That's discussed in the client section. There's a similar server section. I'm sorry, I should have added that one too. But 3.2.5.1.10 talks about decompression. If decompression fails, which is kind of rare, most decompression algorithms don't really have integrity checking. If the size is mismatched, is the usual result. Because remember, when we send it, there's an original segment size up there at the upper right. And so if the decompressed segment doesn't match, that would be bad, right? We have an invalid response that we're, you know, trying to handle. We can't handle it. We drop the connection. We treat this like any other protocol error. It drops the connection. If the size matches, but it's still garbage, inevitably we'll drop the connection. Integrity checking or some other processing in SMB2 will probably catch this. Anyway, I guess this actually increases the importance of integrity protection. Oh, and of course, if the decompression algorithm explicitly has a failure indication, right? This would be triggered. A little bit of commentary, though. Compression, as I've said several times, is optional. The protocol document specifically says we don't send a compressed segment if the payload is not smaller. It's possible to take an incoming segment, compress it, and find it something larger. That we simply go back to the original segment when that occurs. Generally speaking, the client and server are expected to only compress large and data-bearing operations, right? Bulk data. That's the scenario that we expect, if you will, for this. It's a separate decision on both client and server and on each operation, however. So there's, you know, some assembly required. You go through this process every time something needs to be compressed. So optional has many implications here. We always compress, and I recommend everybody always compress prior to encryption. Encrypted data compresses really, really badly. So there's no point in compressing after encryption. And second, some encryption ciphers also compress. SSL is famous for having a compression bit, for instance. That's just a simple example. SSL isn't a cipher, but it's, you know, that sort of approach. And if your encryption algorithm also compresses, it may impact the benefit of compression prior to that. So you may consider that compression become optional if an encryption algorithm is used, encryption cipher is used, which implements compression. Some things to think about, but always compress prior to encryption, never after. It is also optional to compress SMB headers. The protocol document doesn't talk about this because we're not in the business of giving implementation advice. But I want to point out there's an offset field right back here called the compression offset. That doesn't have to point at the header. It can point into the middle of the payload. It can point at a block of data. Windows, when this occurs, typically will do this. It will not compress the header, and it will compress the block of data. It typically does that when the block of data is one page or better, 4 kilobytes. And it does that by basically looking for a scatter-gather list in the send, right? If there's no scatter-gather, then it's all inline. If there's a scatter gather, then there's a page attached to it. Pages are a strong clue that there's bulk data. That's the way Windows does it. That's not the way everybody has to do it. But it is nonetheless supported by the protocol. This compression offset was the reason we went from 4 to 3. We realized in the original protocol that we published in the preview, we didn't have a compression offset. You had to compress the entire message from the header all the way to the end. And we said, that's silly, you know. Nobody wants to always have to compress headers, you know. You may want to actually pre-process the thing, you know, in an iterative way while the headers are there. You don't want to have to iterate all through the bulk data. Like, for instance, maybe the thing is too big, right? Maybe your data segment size is too large. You don't know the data segment size till you've decompressed it, but you can't look at the header to figure out what that would have been. So there's a lot of advantages to protocol processing via this compression offset. It's a single segment, though. Okay, there's a single offset. So you can't scatter. You can't say, I'm going to compress this, then not compress, then compress, then not in a single message. It's all, you know, at some point, there's a length of compressed data. You could have stuff uncompressed after it, but that would be weird, but possible. A couple of slides from Matthew's presentation back last September at SDC help maybe root the compression performance story a little bit. There are two slides here, and they're almost the same, but I think they're a couple of interesting things. Anyway, with pattern data, with pattern data, where compression wins, there's a nice win. You go from 100 megabits to 400 megabits, right? You get a 4x improvement in wire throughput, effective wire throughput. With random data, you still get a significant one. It goes from 100 to 168, okay? 68% instead of 400%. But actually 300% technically, right? The random data still benefits from a lot of this stuff. On a 200 megabit network, that once again using the Express algorithm, the pattern data had a similar increase, but you notice the random data had a smaller increase. I thought this was interesting. We used less of the available compression bandwidth with this. I believe that has to do with the additional overhead of the data streams. But compression I'm going to just try to summarize this as compression performance can be hard to measure in a meaningful, universal way, right? It's a very algorithmic heuristic sort of a decision that you're going to be making. And it can change based on the payload of the data. So, don't jump to the conclusion that compression's always a win. All right? Think about it. And maybe have some counters and statistics that help you validate your decisions long into the future. There's no absolute decision here, I'm convinced. Our compression use cases, the ones that, you know, we, Microsoft, we, the protocol designers, consider that it's primarily for reads and write, that it's a bulk data, you know, payload sort of a thing, not metadata, right? Not the metadata fetching and setting, not ioctl and fs control, but it's possible to do those too, right? You can easily use this to compress every message you send. Primarily, it's for bulk data on long haul networks, right? Long pipes. Pipes with large latencies, with limited bandwidth, stuff you want to just pack that pipe as much as possible. It's also useful for specialized local transfers, file copy, migration, things like that. It is not the kind of thing I would recommend enabling globally, enabling unconditionally. It's going to add a lot of CPU, and it's going to change your workloads when that happens. So, you know, consider it for very specific types of data streams or connections. It's a client opt-in. The client pretty much kicks it off by saying, I'm willing to compress. The server, if the client doesn't say he's willing to compress, obviously the server can't compress. So the client starts the process. It's the client that turns the light green for compression. Compression future. Alternative compression algorithms, Chris's question. The ones that we've supported out of the box in Windows are really basic. They're supported by the Windows compression library. But there are some really interesting types of payloads that are definitely going to benefit. Hyper-V and VHDX, the virtual hard disk format that Hyper-V uses, some optimization to that. There's the storage, the VHDX storage. There's also the Hyper-V migration, which occurs over SMB in Windows. These have very interesting data patterns. A run-length limited type algorithm is really appealing for these. You get a block of zeros. You get a block of some data that's highly regular and predictable. A run-length algorithm can be super efficient. You know, say 4,096 bytes of zero, please. That can be represented in just a very small payload. You get extreme compression for this type of data payload. But you need a cipher, a compression algorithm that recognizes and uses this. We don't do that today. It's still a per operation and per payload discussion, but we're strongly thinking about it. So that one for sure. If there are any other optimizations, you know, for the types of files or for whatever, some proprietary compression algorithm, great, you know, let's talk about it. The namespace is, 16 bits of ID, and it is open to discussion should people be interested. Another question that I hinted at earlier is the interaction between compression and encryption, the type of transport, etc. Compression, when encryption also implements it, I'm going to compare this to the situation where we don't sign when we use authenticated encryption. Authenticated encryption has integrity protection, so we don't sign packets when we do an authenticated encryption transfer. We already do that in SMB. This is the same sort of thing, you know. If we're encrypting, maybe we don't need to compress, depending on the cipher we've selected. That is not currently supported by any of the ciphers that we have in SMB, but in a moment you'll see the future, and this is something that's on our roadmap. Compression over RDMA may have different goals from regular compression. It may no longer be a bandwidth question. It changes the benefit equation. The RDMA transport already drops the CPU requirement on the floor. I mean, we do tens of millions of IOPS at single-digit CPU when we have an RDMA transport. So maybe compression over RDMA has a different goal. You know, maybe there's more CPU available, and maybe compression makes sense because RDMA might be bandwidth limited. I don't know. RDMA generally is not today. It's generally not deployed in bandwidth limited situations. But I think we have a new set of parameters to think through. It's not a simple how much data can I jam down this pipeline question. So there's a lot more thinking going on down there. The only other feature in SMB3 recently is this so-called net name negotiate context, in which the client provides a target server name by appending this new negotiate context ID number 5. There's a name length and a Unicode null terminated name. Don't ask me why we have a length and a null terminated name, but that's the way the protocol landed. This is basically the server name that the client thinks it's connecting to, right? And that would be the server name that it would provide later when it performed its first tree connect. Right, it would say connect to whack whack server name whack share name. But tree connect happens really late. Tree connect happens after we've logged into a session, after we've negotiated the protocol, after we've done all the initial setup stuff. And so it would be desirable by load balancers, connection managers, etc., to get a hint early on. Clustered servers, for instance. I'm serving because I had to take him over this other guy's name at this present time, right? A load balancer may be aware of this and may be able to deflect it. The load balancer itself may have redirected the connection up front. This is not a man-in-the-middle type load situation, right? This is simply something that's redirected a connection attempt. So, you know, I believe Samba had this problem early on with RDMA because of the file descriptor passing solution that it has for server negotiate and session establishment. Maybe this server name could help here. I don't know. Right. Yep. Yep. The old NB name stuff. Yep. 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 So it's familiar to us, but here it is again. It's super simple. It's a net name negotiate context ID, that thing that I just had, that's included with the negotiate by default. And that is all. There's no response. There's only an advertisement at the request. There's no server processing. The server ignores it. It's basically just a little decoration on the packet. The server could look at it. Our server doesn't. Another server might. Our client includes it by default, the new client. So it's there. If you got good ideas, by all means. That's it for the protocol. Couple updates to the client. I'm going to start to move a little quicker because I don't want to run into lunch. There are two new info levels. There's a file normalized name information. This is new to the new document. It is the normalized name query. We've added it to the protocol. There are a number of Windows scenarios that wanted to perform this operation remotely, and previously we blocked it. Right? Any non-documented file info level gets blocked by default by the protocol. So that's been added to the protocol. That normalized name information was already in the FSA backend. It was supported by Windows. We just started pushing it over the wire. And another one that looks just like that is the file ID information that I recently discovered was shipped in Windows 8. And it didn't get into the document. So it's now in the document. It's in Windows 8, and it is issued by the Windows 8 client. It's okay to fail it. The Windows 8 client is perfectly happy to have it fail. But it would be a little happier if it succeeded. So I would encourage server vendors, Samba included, to support this info level. It's all in the rest of the documents. It's in FSA. It's just now, it's in the white list. That's basically all we did. We added it to the SMB white list. It's one of those info levels that's passed through. So these are the two new info levels. A couple of implementation changes in the client. There's a lot of directory caching enhancements. It's led to some surprising behaviors on the client. I think we may tune these as time goes on. But we can really cache really huge directories now, 500,000 entries. It will attempt directory queries with larger buffers as well, right? We used to use 64K, now we're using up to a megabyte. That is subject to the other limits that have been negotiated on the connection, but it will do really big directory queries and it'll cache the heck out of them. And there's an accelerated IO path that we call turbo mode for low latency access. There's no wire implication here, but there's a bunch of changes internally to improve the performance. And then there are a couple of other document updates that you'll see here and there. We added a normative reference to the XCA, the Express Compression Algorithm, just for supporting compression. And there are numerous clarity and language tweaks. I'm really happy with some of these. You have to look at sort of the last three versions to see them. They've increased lately. But the input and output buffer sizes and counts were spottily covered. There was a lot of copied and pasted text, and it kind of got out of sync as a result. When one area was updated, another one wasn't. We've tried to make them very uniform and refer to common sections. Transform processing. When we shipped the March 13th version, we had an encryption transform and a compression transform, and they were in totally different parts of the document, and you had to jump all over the place to figure out what was going on. Transforms, however, are sort of the the last thing done when we're sending a message and the first thing done when we're receiving a message. And they're very much the normal processing of a message. So I moved the sections around. There's now dealing with transforms up top, and then encryption and compression sit as subsections of those. So it reads much more sanely. And it was also possible to condense a lot of text as a result. So I think it's easier to read and higher quality reading now. Oplock and least break client processing, we had actually no processing defined for this. There's not a lot of processing, but there is a little. So we added some new sections. Tree Connect and Redirect were unwound and fixed. Durable Connect V2 was also improved. And compound processing, this dates back to the September 18H2 document, was updated as well. A lot of, the rules for processing compounds. So you might want to take a look at those clarity changes. No bugs, just fixes, improvements. All right, that brings me to the speculative part of the discussion here, our protocol futures. And I just want to give you a preview of what's coming. You're going to see some of these at SDC 2019 coming up in September. I know lots of Samba people are planning to come. You should definitely come. It's in Santa Clara. It's the final week of September, the 24th through the 27th, I believe, are the dates. Co-located with the SMB Plugfest, the public Plugfest that we host with NetApp at the SDC event every year. So there are three basic areas, and you've seen them before. But I'm just going to ring the bell again, and that's why it can be quick. SMB over quick, new transforms and signing, and RDMA push mode. So quick. Quick is a new protocol from the IETF and Google. Google initiated it, and now it's an IETF open process. It has a couple of really interesting features. The first one is fascinating feature, may not be too important for SMB in my opinion, but because SMB generally has long-lived connections, but it may lead to future enhancements. It basically highly optimized for round trip. It's secure and encrypted by default, and it is already proven to have improvements for HTTP2 and TCP replacement. This multiple stream, this ALPN, an application location protocol, no, I forget what it stands for. It's an application identifier. It's a string. It's not a port number, right? You used to work on a port number. I have a new application, a new protocol. I need a port number. The port number is a very precious space, and it's a big, hairy thing. Quick has defined this thing called an ALPN that a lot of other protocols have. And it provides for really convenient multiplexing. You'll see a lot of advantages there.
That's NBT. NBT does that.
A lot of protocols have done this over time. That doesn't really matter, but that's true. It has congestion control. It's UDP based. It's encrypted. It's not it's not tampered with by middle boxes, etc. It's rapidly approaching final IETF standardization. It's supposed to happen already, but as always, they're very optimistic. Initial implementations are software only. You're going to see a lot of hardware implementations coming up. SMB bindings for Quick. Quick connections can share the same four tuple. There's a multiplexing over the ALPN. And so there's some significant possibilities here. Today, we propose using Quick simply as a single channel TCP replacement, where we would create a multi-channel connection, now we would create a quick connection. We would not do anything more. We would not currently leverage quick streams. We're not going to dig down into the quick protocol and extend it that way yet. But the goal is, can quick penetrate firewalls? Can it get the advantage that we see with quick in the internet today? And in particular, can it be hooked up to Azure files? That would be cool. No promises, but this is where we hope to lead. Second area, signing improvements. We've talked in 2015 about this thing called GMAC, the Galois Message Authenticity Control, whatever it is. You know, signing with Galois instead of with the CCM, we'd move to GCM. We had a big benefit from moving to GCM because processors implement it much better. SMB is still using CMAC, and CMAC is, you know, less efficient. Can we use GMAC to similarly improve signing? Absolutely, definitely, yes. Radically, way better. So we proposed to negotiate SMB signing with yet another negotiate context that lists a set of alternative signing algorithms. Okay, CCM would still be the primary one that would be used if no other negotiate context were done, but we would, similarly to the way compression and other things work, negotiate a list. Initially, GMAC, single algorithm, but if it's popular, if people have other ideas, others are possible. Finally, a similar thing, signing and encryption in RDMA. Currently, we turn them off with RDMA. No signing, no encryption. Performance drops too much, basically, when we touch the data prior to RDMA. There's a lot of demand, however, to always encrypt or always sign. And so we want to support this. We want to avoid these middle buffers. And or avoid the cost of those middle buffers and do it over RDMA. A transform descriptor as a channel payload makes a lot of sense. The channel payload already exists. We have type 0, 1, and 2 for none, RDMA, V1, and RDMA invalidate. What we would add is RDMA signing and encryption. And this would provide an additional payload for signing and encryption over an RDMA transport. So you can think of it as sort of a second transform, but it's really the only transform because we don't currently apply the transform over RDMA. Anyway, this was talked about at last SDC. It'll be talked about again at the coming one, a little more reality. And the last one, push mode. This is my personal favorite that I've been working on forever. We've talked about this many times. We actually have it working, and we may actually be able to show something about this. It allows a zero-copy client push over RDMA into a DAX persistent memory file system on the server. Extraordinarily low latency, single-digit microsecond writes, something we've never, ever had over a networked file system. Minimal changes are required, which is pretty cool. There's an RDMA protocol extension that's moving forward, although I admit, slowly. I am annoyed, but it's inevitable. Protocols are hard. There are two operations, RDMA flush and atomic write. We really only need flush, so it's a very simple situation. The SMB protocol extensions are actually none. The SMB3 protocol is not extended. There's only some new FS controls. The client requests push mode with one FS control, gets it back from the server if the server chooses to allow it. The client performs an RDMA write or an RDMA read or write instead of an RDMA instead of an SMB2 operation. So it basically tunnels below the SMB protocol, and the client flushes with an RDMA extension if it's available or an FS control if it's not, and we'll be able to show all that stuff. More details on all of those topics will be available at SDC 2019, so please come. And before I end, I just have one more thing. Microsoft remains interested in helping Samba co-develop any number of things. Actually, whatever Samba's interested in, we're interested in. Microsoft, Heart, Linux, you've seen that stupid thing. It really does mean it. We really do mean it. It really does matter to us. We host Linux like stink in the cloud. And we interoperate with Linux everywhere, right? So Samba is really important to us in improving the fidelity of Linux and whatever other open operating systems to the SMB3 protocol and therefore to Windows interoperability. And all these things are things we're interested in working with you on. So let's continue to discuss. I just want to say that's why I'm here, and that's why our protocol support teams are here. You know, we want to reach out to you and work with you and solicit new work. We've actually got people who could probably help you code. And oh, by the way, death to SMB1. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So if there are any questions, now would be a 5-minute window for this. And can you please repeat the question so we have it on the audio recording?
Sure.
Thank you.
Jeremy. Will there be a prototype quick implementation to test against at SDC? I hope so. I am not sure.
Exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you we have it working.
Yeah.
But, you know, from us to us, whether we can make it available more broadly is a sort of a deployment question.
Yeah.
But that would be the hope. Yeah, we have RDMA, we have Quick, we have TCP, we have all versions of SMB, so, you know, it'd be very, fit right in. Yes?
So on that last slide, you wrote Azure Test Infrastructure for Samba. I'm just curious
at what you sort of imagine there. Azure Test Infrastructure for Samba. Yeah, so Samba has an automated test procedure, right, which you know, is a gateway to a required gateway before any release. Running that in Azure makes good sense to me. Also, RDMA is possible in Azure. The HPC SKUs in Azure support RDMA. These are resources that Microsoft owns and can, you know, help share. If Samba's interested in this, I'm putting it on the table here. Okay. For the record, Andrew Bartlett thinks it would be very cool to get off the current infrastructure and onto another one. Okay, I'm being silly. But yeah, so, you know, this is a possibility. We are using it internally. I mean, Steve French is using Azure for his testing, for instance. So, anyway. And Steve.
Yeah, just to throw out the idea. So we have like 5 targets. Now, my goal is on a check-in or a sending request to Linux, we want to run against Samba, right? So running against Azure, Windows, Samba, we have these various targets, DFS, whatever. The problem is that that's the reverse of what we might want, right? We might want every week or every day or every something, make sure the real client wasn't broken, but on a Samba check-in, right? So we do these on check-ins. And you have your own, obviously, like 200,000 lines of code, right, for testing torture. The only thing I'm running into, really the only thing, and it's probably trivial, but the idea that we welcome is it would save, you know, 70% of the cost if we could auto shut down the VM when we're done. We could save 80% of the cost if I knew how to do that. It's probably something very trivial in Azure. But like literally spinning up the VMs is easy, the build files, and Palo in was great, and you can do this exact same thing for Samba. The only thing I'm running into is I just don't know how to shut them down automatically when they're done.
So, Steve, I don't know how to summarize that for the record, but you know, Samba testing in cloud, good.
And ask these guys who did all the hard work.
Great. All right, well, I'm keeping you from lunch, so I'm around the next day and two, and, you know, let's talk. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We have a little present for you as well. It's a speaker for the speaker.